Good evening and welcome to Be Behind the News for January 13, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with at least one person, possibly two, Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert, who are with something called Karma Bank, a London-based institution that's attacking bad companies, or as they put it, companies that suck, according to a social audit, behavior, good behavior, bad behavior. And they're doing so now by launching a hedge fund, which will attack the stocks of bad companies. So we'll talk to them about what they're up to. And then at the bottom of the hour, certainly a little off-the-beaten-track guest, Lou Rockwell, who is a libertarian and has a blog at lourockwell.com. That's L-E-W, Rockwell. And also is the head of something called the Von Mises Institute in Alabama. And he is a libertarian, which is usually associated with the political right, but he has a piece that was on his website about a week or 10 days ago, The Reality of Red State Fascism. And he's very nervous about the Bush administration and what it represents, and wants to make common cause with the left. And when I asked him to be on this show, he says he loves Pacifica. So a meeting of somewhat like and somewhat unlike minds across the telephone lines, and that'll be at about 5:30 or a little after. Then just a couple of the economic headlines before we get to the show. The weekly tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, released every Thursday morning at 8:30 by the Department of Labor, reporting on activity for the previous week. So it's a very timely, very accurate, very important indicator of what's going on in the job market. That tally rose by 10,000 last week, after a 36,000 increase the previous week. And the four-week moving average, which is designed to smooth out the week-to-week bumpiness of this measure, has also risen by 13,000 over the last week to 344,000. This is a significant increase and kind of a surprise. Now, they do have problems adjusting for the seasonal anomalies around the holidays, the at Christmas, New Year's, and such. So that may be some of the problem. But it also suggests that the labor market may actually be weakening a little bit. And certainly last week's employment report was a bit of a disappointment. Only about 150,000 new jobs, less than a lot of people, including me, were expecting. And so the economic recovery that had left the job market behind for 2002-2003, the job market was picking up in part of 2004, but still pretty weak, and actually showing signs of some weakening. So we'll see if anything comes of that, or if this is sustained in the coming weeks. But at the moment, not a very good sign. Also not a very good sign is the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index for the U.S. economy, which is designed to measure where the economy is going, or predict, rather, where the economy is going to go 3 or 6 or 9 months ahead. That index fell last week and is after rising from October through mid-December, has now fallen off a bit. So it did correctly forecast a slowdown in the economy in the second half of last year. It did was forecasting a bit of a pickup for the early part of this year, but now that's again slowing a bit. So again, we'll have to look at what happens in coming weeks, but not a good sign. The Mortgage Bankers Association's measure of applications for mortgages also declining. The housing market has been very, very strong, of course, for the last several years. But as interest rates have been creeping up and the Fed has been tightening policy and pushing up rates, housing market finally showing some signs of cooling down. Now, it was also reported last week that consumer credit, which is credit cards and auto loans and things like that, credit other than home mortgages, That fell, took its big one of its biggest declines ever in the month of November. While people have been using their credit cards less and borrowing against the value of their houses more, the slowdown in borrowing for home mortgages also is a sign that maybe credit is the great credit binge of the last several years maybe cooling down a bit. Now, there's an axiom in the trade that the dangerous time for a credit bubble is not when it's still expanding, but when it starts contracting. So we'll see if we're in that more dangerous phase or whether it's just a pause. But I think the U.S. economy may be sensitive to higher interest rates, and we'll see if that is borne out in the coming months. A very important story there. It was also reported this morning, retail sales for the month of December up very strongly, 1.2% of the month, but that was mostly extremely strong demand for cars and SUVs. Americans have been buying cars and SUVs like crazy. There is really no recession in that market. Usually there is, but there wasn't this time around. But also a pretty robust, not exuberant, but fairly robust Christmas buying. People are, even though the job market's not doing so well, people are stretching. They're spending every dime they've got and then some, apparently. Also reported this morning, or yesterday rather, the U.S. balance of trade, bad number on that. The big, gigantic trade deficit for the month of November, over $60 billion. It should be contracting a little bit now as the dollar has been weakening. That makes imports more expensive and exports cheaper, but that's not happening yet. So U.S. foreign balance still a problem, and people at the Federal Reserve hinting that they're actually getting kind of concerned about that. So we'll see what that means in the coming months as well. But lots of imbalances in the U.S. economy, fairly weak job market and people borrowing a lot, although that may be slowing down, really no slowdown in housing or automobiles or purchases of expensive durable goods and things like that, which you usually see in recessions. That didn't happen in the 2001 recession. So consumption in the U.S. is still very, very strong, which has been driving our foreign accounts deeper into the red. If this were a normal economy, there'd be hell to pay. But this is not a normal economy. This is a superpower economy. So we'll see exactly how a superpower gets its books back into balance. It could be interesting. And then finally, a couple of complaints came in over the email about my appearance yesterday on Hugh Hamilton's show and my unwillingness there to apply the word insurance to Social Security. Now, this is, pardon me for getting pedantic here, but I was a little reluctant to use the words insurance because I don't think that's exactly the right word. Dictionary definition is coverage by a contract binding a party to indemnify another against a specified loss in return for premiums paid. Economists talk about the transference of risk or the spreading about of risks. But it must be a large pool so that it behaves like in a statistically predictable way. Now, for example, if you have a group of 10 people, a number of them suffering a bad fate like getting hit by a bus or having their house burned down could be anywhere from 0 to 10. But if you've got 1 million people, you can project with a considerable degree of confidence how many of them are likely to suffer an unlucky fate. Policyholders pay in premiums, and a more or less predictable share of those premiums will get paid out as settlements to a minority of policyholders. Various kinds of insurance, auto, health, and fire fit this description. Social Security is conceptually something different. Most of us reach retirement age. We're not insuring against uncertainty and risk, having our house burned down or having ourselves get hit by a bus. We're preparing instead for something that's highly likely to happen. So that's why I was a little reluctant to use the word insurance. So let's take this little musical break and come back with some folks from Karma Bank. We'll be right back. And then a little excerpt from Glenn Branca's guitar, or rather, lesson number one, going back to the New York City of about 25 years ago when marginal art rockers like him could afford to live in the Lower East Side and or Lofts in Soho, a very different era. And we'll hear some more excerpts from that same song later in the show. I guess it's really not a song. It's a piece, isn't it? And now we're joined on the line by Max Keiser and waiting with him, Stacey Herbert. They're both with an entity called the Karma Bank, B-A-N-Q-U-E. And they've been using financial techniques to target very bad companies. And they're about to launch a hedge fund. And I've heard that just about everyone in London seems to be launching a hedge fund, but this is breaking some new ground. So welcome to WBAI, Max.
Hello, Doug. We're here in London. I'm here with Stacey. Per your request, I know you're dying to get a female voice on the show, so we've got Stacey standing by.
All right, well, thank you for that.
Through the gloom and doom. My God, I've been listening to your show for the last 5 minutes. I'm going to jump out the window.
No, please don't do that. I was reading off dismal scientists' cheat sheets for some of those numbers, but we try not to be too dismal here. You were the subjects of an article in today's New York Sun, and which makes you famous among 20,000 people who read that newspaper. we've heard of, many of us have heard of socially responsible mutual funds which aim to invest in the stocks of what they perceive as good companies. You're doing something a little different. You're really attacking bad companies. So tell us what you're up to.
Yeah, that's right, Doug. Social responsible investing tries to put money to work in companies that are perceived to be doing good. The purpose of Karma Bank is to take money away from companies that are doing bad. And there's a couple of advantages to this approach, which I can get into. The hedge fund is part of that. The Karma Bank website is part of that. We track the global dissent market, if you will, try to keep up to date on which companies are the most hated around the world. Then we filter that information with what we call the boycott vulnerability ratio, which was a simple look at the price of the stock relative to sales or the price of the stock relative to earnings. And we try to find vulnerable, overvalued companies that people hate. And then we recommend to our hedge fund constituency to sell these companies short, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this. It's the way
They may not, actually. Short selling is one of those things that a lot of lay people have a hard time understanding. So could you give us a definition?
Yeah, it is, as they say, counterintuitive, but short selling. You know, it's a widely practiced technique on Wall Street. I think 20% of all the trades on the New York Stock Exchange are actually short sales. And it's a matter of borrowing stock that you don't own. You're just borrowing stock, immediately selling it in the open marketplace and hoping that the price goes down. And if it does go down, you buy back that stock that you borrowed and sold, and you return it from where you borrowed it from. And if the price, in fact, has gone down, you've pocketed the difference as a profit. So this is a standard short sale. An easier way to do it probably is just to buy a put option or an option on a stock that will pay off if the price of the stock goes down. Here in the UK, we have something called spread betting, which is a huge industry in the UK, which is kind of like the poor man's option market. Gives you a chance for a minimal amount of money, $100 or $200, to actually make a bet against a company. And in this month's issue of The Ecologist magazine, who I write for and who were co-sponsoring this fund idea, we're explaining to people how they can take a spread bet against a vulnerable company like Coca-Cola while simultaneously boycotting Coca-Cola, telling your friends to boycott Coke. The more friends you tell, the greater probability your short sale or negative bet will go up. So you got some skin in the game. So you're going to actually pay yourself to boycott this company. So it's all about the marriage, really, of the hedge fund industry, which is a $1 trillion industry, with the global NGO, nonprofit, 26,000 NGO strong industry, which is almost a $1 trillion industry in itself, and coming up with a whole new way to campaign against companies, pressuring them on the one thing that they hold near and dear, which is their stock price, that's the nutshell explanation.
And whenever the topic of short selling comes up, I always like to quote that old rhyme, "He that sells what isn't his and buys it back or goes to prison." So,
I think Ben Franklin said that shortly before he got zapped by a bolt of lightning. And then he said, "A penny saved is probably not as great as a penny borrowed to mortgage your house for the third time so you can afford that Lexus car that you really can't afford. Or something like that. You know, Ben Franklin, he said a lot of stuff that didn't make it into the almanac.
No, he certainly didn't. And the second half of Patrick Henry's quote, give me freedom or give me death, but preferably give me freedom. Give me liberty or give me death, but preferably give me liberty, also didn't make it into the history books. Let's tell us about the hedge fund. Is it established, or are you looking for people to put some money into it?
We're taking indications of interest. We're hoping to raise $100 million by the end of the first quarter of this year. We're working with The Ecologist magazine and Zach Goldsmith. Zach Goldsmith is the son of Sir Jimmy Goldsmith, who your New York listeners may remember from the 1980s, a very famous corporate raider, made billions of dollars. Zach Goldsmith is his son and inherited those billions of dollars. And so we're putting together this $100 million fund by the end of this quarter, which will be actively selling short these companies that have fallen in disfavor amongst various activist groups around the world. And we're going to donate 98% of any profits to groups that need the money, that have been left out of the development cycle, or as we say, the victims of the American business model.
The normal arrangement for a hedge fund, of course, is the managers take a fee, maybe 1 or 2% of the assets under management, maybe 20% of the profits, and then return the rest to the investors. How are you working that?
Yeah, exactly. The investors are going to take, we're going to shoot for them some benchmark, like maybe LIBOR plus 1% or something. But anything above and beyond that, we're going to give away. And the incentive for the investors to participate in this is actually, for them, a lot of these people who we're talking to who are multi-hundred millionaire and billionaires, they've got huge real estate portfolios, for example. They're concerned about the effects of climate change and global warming and how it affects their huge real estate portfolios. So an opportunity to actually get the global community to push back against corporations in a way that maybe will push back that timeline before, especially in the UK here, the flooding that's from climate change is becoming an uninsurable risk now for a lot of the Swiss Re, for example, has said we can't even insure these properties in the UK anymore. They've got a 200,000 home blacklist, which they expect to go to 3 million homes in the next 10 years, where they're not going to offer insurance on these homes. So a lot of these rich people here in the UK, they're looking for ways to push back that climate change from the 20 to 25-year horizon where their private property will be uninsurable. So they're figuring that maybe we've got a way to push that timeline back. We've had interest from some Saudi investors, but there's obviously a political element there that we don't want to get into. It's just about, getting the right mix of people. And we've got about, I'd say last I counted, 15 million in indications of interest, and we'll see how this shapes up over the next two and a half months.
And who are your targets? I'm looking at the list from your website. The top five here, I got Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Microsoft, Ryanair, a discount airline, and ExxonMobil. So these are your top five corporate targets?
Yeah, so Coca-Cola is it's top of the list because you've got campaigns against this company all over the world, in India and Colombia, from health people. There's really a lot of animus directed toward Coca-Cola all over the world. And the stock is still trading at a pretty rich multiple, so it's vulnerable to a boycott, as well as being hated by people around the world. So you put those two together, and it qualifies it for the number one stock that would be we recommend to be looked at by both boycotters and hedge funds. And since we put this Coke on the list, the stock was at 50. It's now at 40, 40 and a half. So we've already booked some pretty significant gains advising people to sell this short. We've tracked the 10 most vulnerable companies last year using this double metric of vulnerability and global activist dislike. And those 10 stocks, if you sold short all 10, you would have made 5.5% on your money, which was better than the Dow Jones. So it's the year before that, the index, similar index, performed. It was up 20%, and that. So there's a huge trend actually in looking at companies that are going to get squeezed by the environmental and social risks that they have been able to successfully put off their balance sheets, if you will, the past couple of decades. With all of those, that risk is coming back to haunt them. In an ugly way, if you will, for the stock price. And this is a growing theme, really, in the hedge fund community. I know Bob Monks, who's one of the probably very famous American shareholder activists, who has come out and said he thinks that for the next 10 years, this environmental risk theme is going to be the, one of the defining themes of the hedge fund business and the money management business in the world. So Cormor Bank is kind of, I think we're on the bleeding edge of this, because when we started 3 years ago, nobody had really thought to marry the hedge fund community with the global activist community in this way. So I think we're getting a lot of attention now, especially since the real-time consequences of things like climate change are really starting to hit home, and people are really unable to ignore it. And they're looking for ways to, A, profit from it, B, deal with it, and just it becomes part of their daily lives. They have to really incorporate it in their daily lives. And anyway, Cormor Bank tries to focus on one thing and one thing only. If you're interested in decapitalizing these companies, pushing back this corporate menace, really the only thing you can really should focus on is the stock price, because that's what anyone in the state certainly are on Wall Street. They're glued to that one number. That's their heartbeat, if you will. The ticker tape is the heartbeat of America. If you can affect that, then you've really got people's attention, and that's what we're aiming to do. We're aiming to basically put that entire system into retreat, if you will.
Now, a question that's very dear to my household, because my wife has just recently published a book about Walmart's abuse of its women workers.
Yeah.
Eliza Featherstone is her name, and the book is Selling Women Short, interestingly
okay.
enough. But you've got Walmart about number 17 in the list. Why is it so far down?
Well, Walmart, because the stock is not that vulnerable in that the stock price itself is not trading at a very high multiple relative to sales. So, for example, let me just walk you through why this is important. For an activist, they only have the ability to boycott maybe one or two things at a time, because after that, your lifestyle really starts to kind of fall apart. So you have to pick your boycott strategically. Now, Walmart is trading for something like, for every dollar you don't spend at Walmart, the price-to-sales multiple is such that you're going to be subtracting less than $2 of market cap from Walmart shareholders. Whereas if you focused on Coca-Cola, the number is closer to 5. So by simply switching from a Walmart to a Coke boycott, you've leveraged your boycott, your dissent buck, by a significant factor. And so what we're trying to get people, and especially in the activist community, is to act as a coalition, to act with some reciprocity, and to focus on those vulnerable companies first, like a Coke. And then, you know, Walmart will have its day in terms of implementing this particular strategy. But as long as Walmart's price-to-sales ratio is not attractive enough to warrant a global mass strategic boycott, then it will remain low on the list. Now, having said that, there is a way to trump the low price-to-sales ratio, and that is just by sheer mass of interest. For example, ExxonMobil also has a very low price-to-sales multiple. It's also a company that's not vulnerable particularly to this type of strategic boycott. But there are so many people willing to boycott ExxonMobil, even though it would take 5 times the numbers to equal the effect on a Coca-Cola. You might actually attract 5 times the numbers, because the company has outraged that many people. So you see ExxonMobil, even though it's not a very strategic boycott, it's still in the top 5 simply because there's so much hatred directed to this company all over the world. It's hard to go to a territory anywhere in the world and not find somebody who is really, really has issues with this company, ExxonMobil. But it's not particularly strategic. Coca-Cola is a great boycott for this because it's got a very high multiple. So as the hedge fund is going to be able to capture more gains by selling that stock short. Microsoft is a very vulnerable company, and McDonald's was more vulnerable a couple of years ago than it is now. The stock price has recovered in the last 12 months, so it's becoming more vulnerable again. Starbucks is extremely vulnerable to a boycott. It's an extremely overblown stock price. If you know, very few numbers of strategic boycotters could really knock 10, 20, 30% off Starbucks stock price in a heartbeat, which would generate huge profits in the hedge fund, which then we give away to groups that have been left out of the development cycles of the past 2 or 3 decades.
And what kind of groups do you have in mind there?
Well, we try to go with the direction of the, you know, as a matter of fact, I know you really wanted to get Stacy on the phone. So maybe one idea that we were talking about that she can speak on for a second is, I don't know if you're familiar with Grameen Bank.
All right, well, let's pass the line over to her. I have been speaking with
She's
Max
gonna
Kaiser.
She's going to say hello. Here's Stacy, the president of Karma Bank.
I've been speaking with Max.
Hello.
Okay, welcome to the air, Stacy Herbert.
Hello.
So you've got some ideas of good guys to talk about.
Oh, I've got some good ideas about Grameen Bank, which is the microcredit for Asian third world countries. And one of our ideas was to pay off some of the microcredit loans.
Ah, so... And what else?
As a way, rather than, say, the World Bank, who's, for example, with Southeast Asia, is suffering from the tsunamis, they're pushing another $1.5 billion loan, which is going to go to, say, Indonesia to buy some more weapons to put down the rebels in Banda Aceh. You know, rather than, you know, we support for local, the actual women who want to send, the, you know, rebuild their homes or put their children through school or get some health care. The Grameen Bank provides micro loans to the actual citizens in these countries rather than to corrupt governments.
And the idea would, by paying back their loans, they get some free money.
Yes.
Instead of getting more debt, as the official development model would rather impose on them.
Well, exactly. Paying off somebody's, you know, whether it's Robert Mugabe or, you know, Abacha, or all these dictators who put their money in Swiss bank accounts.
And
IMF and World Bank loans.
We've only got about a minute left, so tell people about the website, and if they don't have money to put into your hedge fund, how can they investigate or participate?
Well, the website helps you select the most vulnerable of companies to boycott, and, you know, our greatest participants are women, and of course, women make up 80% of the consumer dollar spent, which is about over 2/3 of the U.S. economy alone. And you know, spend your money wisely, and we help you select the companies to boycott,
or places not to spend your money,
and places not to spend your money.
All right, and that website is
KarmaBank.com. KarmaBanque.com.
That's KarmaBank, BanQue.com. And thank you both for joining us, especially at this late hour in London. I've been speaking with, you just heard the voice of Stacy Herbert and her partner, Max Kaiser, who are both with an entity called the Karma Bank. And you can visit them on the web again at KarmaBank, BanQue.com. And let's take a little break and come back in a moment with Lou Rockwell.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
And we are Hi-Fi here, especially at Behind the News. That's the show, and my name is Doug Henwood. And we'll be back in just a moment after a little bit more from Glenn Branca to talk with Lou Rockwell. And that an excerpt from Glenn Branca's Lesson Number 1, which is on a compilation called New York Noise, a collection of pieces from the New York rock dance underground from 1978 to 1982. And if you like that sort of thing, it's a great collection. Liquid Liquid, Conch, Lizzie Mercier de Clou, Material, The Contortions, for aficionados, a rich and memorable sampling. And now we're joined by Lou Rockwell, who is with the von Mises Institute in Alabama and proprietor of a blog at Lou Rockwell, LEWROCKWELL.com. Certainly a little bit off the beaten ideological track for this show. Lou Rockwell, one of the most prominent libertarians in the United States, not a libertarian like the Wall Street Journal editorial page, but a very free-thinking and independent-thinking fellow. He had a piece on his website a couple of weeks ago now, I guess, called The Reality of Red State Fascism. Very catchy title, but also a very interesting argument, and he wants to make some common cause with the left. So I thought it was a good idea to give him a call and have him on the show. Welcome to WBAI, Lou Rockwell.
Doug, great to be with you.
So I think a lot of our listeners, when they hear, libertarian is generally in the conventional political taxonomy put in the right end of the spectrum. A lot of people think of the right end of the spectrum as all jackboots and three-piece suits. you don't exactly fit that description. So tell us, give us some idea of where the libertarian position that you hold fits into the political spectrum.
You mentioned the Wall Street Journal, or as I think of it, the War Street Journal. Probably I'm pretty much the opposite of them. Libertarianism is the view that we agree with Lord Acton that the highest goal of politics is liberty, and that's the highest political value, and nothing comes above it. And so we oppose the central state. It's socialism. It's taxing. It's welfare, corporate and otherwise. And most of all, it's wars, which are, of course, the biggest big government program there is, and entirely, I don't want to offend any of your listeners, but entirely a socialist enterprise, the Pentagon. Although, of course, since we have what might be thought of as a mild fascist regime in this country, in cahoots with the private corporations in what Eisenhower's speechwriter called the military-industrial complex.
One of the striking things about the kind of corporate libertarianism that the Wall Street Journal represents is that they're happily willing to let corporations do whatever they want to, but they're also very eager to let the military do whatever it wants to. What do you think of that kind of position?
Well, I think first of all, the greatest threat to liberty, as some of the founding fathers pointed out, and they certainly weren't the first, is war and is militarism, and with militarism, as Madison said, comes massive national debt and crushing taxation and suppression of civil liberties. That's not an exact quote, but that's what he was talking about. And so it's absolutely true. Every time this government has gotten us involved in a war, and I know that the U.S., of course, always poses as the wronged party. Not very often is that true. And every time they've gotten us involved in a war, it's the greatest thing, as Randolph Bourne pointed out, it's the greatest thing for the government ever. They love war. First of all, it enables them to grab more money for themselves and for their friends. It enables them to stigmatize any dissent from the government as unpatriotic and maybe even traitorous. And it enables them to shut everybody up and to, in cahoots with the media, whose bias always tends towards state bias rather than either liberal bias or conservative bias. They go along with the state. And, see, of course, the most hilarious, awful examples in something like Fox News or in the slightly more sophisticated but every bit as evil direction, the Wall Street Journal. So they are actually only for businesses being allowed to do, the things that their particular clients, I mean, they don't actually like an actual free enterprise system. They like a regulated corporate state as we have today, busily, where the government is busily doing things overseas for the benefit of a favored corporation and doing things here at home, and also to build a state. I mean, the Republican Party is the party of big government among the two parties. Jeffrey Frankel at Harvard argued this a number of years ago, and I think he was exactly right, that the parties have switched ideological position, and by and large, the Democrats are the more fiscally responsible party, and the less government party, I know this sounds crazy, the Republicans are the big government party. Driving through Atlanta this morning, I stopped at a gas station, and there the Atlanta Constitution is heralding the Georgia governor calling for by far the biggest increase in state spending in all of Georgia's history, and promising that there's much more spending on the way. And how is this going to happen? We've got a Republican governor, and for the first time in the history of the state, at least since the federal occupation, we have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and therefore, just like in Washington, the spigot is open for taxing everybody and diverting the money to their pals. And I don't say the Democrats don't do that, because they do, but the Republicans are worse. And, of course, not only are the Republicans worse on war, not only are the Republicans worse on spending, but the Republicans, of course, infinitely worse on civil liberties. I mean, to the credit of the Democrats, they at least have peace constituencies and civil liberties constituencies within their parties, in their party. There are no such constituencies within the Republican Party. I mean, we only have the concentration camp constituency and the war constituency. So that do people think, people like Gonzalez or Kamazar Chertoff, the new head of Homeland Security, and the rest of these goons, they cheer this kind of stuff. They cheer the idea of people being able to, the government being able to jail people for life without a trial, without a lawyer, and keep them in a concentration camp in Cuba. Which, by the way, violates the original treaty with Cuba. If you read the treaty which was imposed on Cuba, so it was wrong to begin with, but the treaty says Guantanamo can only be used for a coaling station for the Navy. In other words, fueling Navy ships. That is, and it says, for no other purpose whatsoever. So the U.S. is illegally using it for a prison camp.
They want to use it as an offshore place where they can violate the law, right? I'm speaking with Lou Rockwell.
Versus the inshore places where they violate the law.
Right, yes. I'm speaking with Lou Rockwell, who is a writer and blogger and founder and president of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, vice president of the Center for Libertarian Studies in Burlingame, California, and says in his website bio, an opponent of the central state, its wars, and its socialism. Again, you can visit his website, lourockwell.com, L-E-W, Rockwell. You alluded to Randolph Bourne's great essay, War is the Health of the State, a little while ago. And if the listeners haven't checked that out, it's widely available on the web. Just Google the words Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E, and War, Health, State, and you'll find it. It's really a splendid thing and very appropriate to read these days.
The state loves, all you need to know about the state is the state loves killing and it loves disasters. They love tsunamis. They love depression. They love stock market crashes. They love floods. They love especially war because it enables them to seize more power from society.
All right, and you, let's get to the meat of this red state fascism piece. People on the left throw around the word fascism sometimes a little recklessly, so it's a little surprising to see you deploy that word to describe the current political environment.
Sure, I mean, and sometimes people on the left have just used it to mean anti-communism and that sort of thing.
Or anything
but
they don't
like. But fascism has a meaning. I mean, there is, you could take the very strict meaning. Lawrence Dennis in the sedition trials under FDR was asked if he was a fascist, and he said, although he was a fascist, and he said, I've never been a member of the Italian Fascist Party. Well, I mean, there's the very narrow view, but if we think of fascism more broadly, it's militarism, it's belligerent nationalism, it's aggressive war, it's suppression of civil liberties, control of the media, and diversion of the people's money into the hands of the corporations connected to the state and favored by the state. And the Italian and other forms of fascism had a big role for labor unions. That's not true in our particular form. Ours is Republican fascism. But it has, I mean, just because they're not marching around in uniforms, although there are far too many people in uniform in this country, but just because Bush and Cheney aren't wearing uniforms doesn't mean that we don't have what is classically a fascist state. Now, it's true it's a mild one, just as the Italian one was milder than the German one and so forth. So there are varieties. But I think we have to worry very much about the trend. And while I would argue as a libertarian that plenty of time in history of the last 100 years, mostly, in fact, the danger to liberty has come from the left in terms of communism and socialism. Today, I would argue the danger is almost entirely from the right, from the fascist right. the neoconservatives, the religious right, all the various constituencies, the freerepublic.com type of people who are always calling for nuking and meaning it. By the way, nuking, you know, France or any country that doesn't want to bow the knee to Washington, D.C. So that's where the threat to liberty comes from. And what I'm saying to libertarians is, look, we have our differences with the left, just like we have our differences with others, but let's realize that on the two key issues right now, which are the issues of, and I would argue, by the way, the left is better on the size of government today in America. But even aside from that, on issues of civil liberties and on issues of war and peace, we need to, first of all, turn down the heat in criticizing the left, because they are much more sound than the right on the key issues, and also maybe learn something from them.
Let's go back. You begin the piece by recalling the Gingrich Revolution of 10 years ago and then portray it as going kind of sour. So could you review that history for us? What did you welcome about the Gingrich Revolution of 10 years ago?
Well, I was an opponent of Gingrich and of the Gingrich Revolution at the time because I thought the whole thing was phony. I didn't really, and I thought it was an attempt. Bill Kristol, we've heard from since, played a very important role in, I think there was some real grassroots anti-government fever in the country. I think that's a very good thing. And I think Gingrich and Kristol and the rest of the neoconservatives set out to turn this into a path where it wouldn't harm the state and wouldn't harm the whole corporate military apparatus. And I think they were successful. And to me, that was the last time that I've seen anything like that in Republican politics. There were some congressmen elected who seem to be, although certainly they've later gone along with every horrible thing that's happened, but they seem to be, certainly they, you know, they seem to be less pro-government than some others. But that, you know, that was the last anytime anybody talked about that. Now, and as Kristol and others urged at the time, said Republicans, stop talking about cutting the government. The government is our friend. We need a conservative government to impose conservative values on society, by which they meant neoconservative values. And we must not criticize the government. In fact, we need a national greatness conservatism, a nationalist conservatism, and we need a big government conservatism. And I think those trends have always been there in the Republican Party. That was Abraham Lincoln, for example, was horrible on civil liberties, government spending, taxing, war, and a million other issues. So this goes right back to the roots of the Republican Party. But the few decent things they did and said coming out of their opposition to Franklin Roosevelt all went by the board. And since then, they've become the party of the state and the state running society for the benefit of themselves and their friends and suppressing, closing down anybody who says boo.
What role did their almost psychotic hatred of Bill Clinton have in this transformation?
Well, it's a very good point because it was a psychotic hatred of Clinton, and a lot of these people on the religious right actually thought he was the Antichrist, and some of them still think he's the Antichrist. And so instead of the conservative masses being interested in cutting government, cutting regulation, taxation, the normal kinds of things that they might have been interested in, they became focused on Clinton as the man, as the focus of evil, and sort of all principle went by the board, and they wanted to go after him. And I might add that the two, in my view, from a libertarian standpoint, the two least bad recent presidents have been Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. They were the two less big government guys than the Republicans. The Republicans have been far worse from a libertarian standpoint. But that whole focus on Clinton, the hatred of Clinton the man, and of course these are the same people who say, oh, don't hate, it's a terrible thing to hate Bush, but of course they encourage this focused, really crazed hatred of Clinton. I've always thought that in some sense it's a miracle he's alive because of the hatreds that were stirred up, and a terrible thing, and it was a very useful thing for the neoconservatives and the other big government conservatives who wanted to see a unity of the Republican Party, the state, the corporate elite, and the military, of course, and the military contractors, and the big banks and the Federal Reserve and the rest of the apparatus against the people.
Now, of course, a lot of the pretext for the aggrandizement of power and the crackdown on civil liberties has been the response to 9/11 and this alleged worldwide war on terror. What would your think the proper response to 9/11 have been? And let's go back. How deeply related is 9/11 to its origins in American imperialism?
Well, I think it's entirely a result of American imperialism, and that doesn't mean that by saying that I'm not justifying what these people did. I'm not for the bombing of buildings full of innocent people, no matter who's doing. Not even if Bush is doing it, am I for it? But what brought that about, it was an entirely reaction to the U.S. being in their faces, in their countries, meddling in their countries for the last 50 or 60 years. Of course, Americans are totally ignorant of this, and as a result, they're for jailing every Muslim. I mean, if you read some of the polls, they're very scary, horrifically scary polls, and people I talk to, and maybe you talk to too, just would like to, you know, put every Muslim in a concentration camp. We wonder how the Nazis were able to get away with stuff. This is how they. This is the sorts of popular feelings they were able to harness. So the U.S., whether we look at Iran or Egypt, I mean, installing the most monstrous dictators, ripping off those people, the Sauds. These are all, of course, U.S. clients, and the people under them don't like it. They don't like it. And we also have to remember that Osama bin Laden is a former U.S. government employee. I don't know if he gets a pension or not. He first came to power and prominence as an agent of the U.S. in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, along with the whole of al-Qaeda and the whole crazy Islamic fundamentalist movement, which the U.S. intensified, gathered together, funded, and armed to go against the Soviets. And this is like the 100,000th and one example of this in American history. Then there's a blowback. It has bad results. Funny thing, when you gather crazies like this, you arm them and you give them money, that it can have a continuing bad effect. So it did have a bad effect. And, of course, with any time there's a disaster, any time there's any kind of, whether it's, Pearl Harbor, which Franklin Roosevelt was on his, was praying for every night, that and doing his best to get the Japanese to attack because he wanted so badly to go into World War II. Same sort of, I think, I don't know whether the Bush administration wanted this to happen. My guess is not. But they sure were happy it happened because all of a sudden it turned Bush from the bumbling boob that everybody knew he was to the great, wartime president, and where he, declared a war on a tactic, terrorism. Terrorism, by the way, is the making of war by private groups. And if you look at the State Department's definition of terrorism, cannot apply to a government. It only can apply to a private group. And it's I don't think war by governments is good, and I don't think war by private groups is good either. I don't like war in either case. But that's what terrorism is. It's not some kind of special demonic thing. It's private people acting like the military and attacking and bombing and doing all the horrible things that the military does and revels in killing, right? This is what the military does, organized killing. That's their that's their shtick. And that's also the thing, of course, of the terrorists. So Bush thought this was the greatest thing ever and, of course, immediately expanded the government, the biggest expansion of the government in many, many years. He's, of course, made LBJ look like a piker. Vast expansion in spending, the vast expansion in bureaucracy, Department of Homeland Security, and all he didn't actually wasn't able to get away with as much bad stuff as he would have liked to. They wanted the full Patriot Act too, and so I think there's actually some good signs about opposition among the American people to this stuff. But I would say that the 9/11 attack was not because we're good, not because we're sweet. Not because women wear short skirts or Fox television runs horrible reality shows. That's not the reason. It was a response to American foreign policy, an entirely illegitimate and evil response, by the way. But when you meddle in other people's countries, when you are responsible for many, many deaths, when you are responsible for fastening the worst kinds of dictators and secret police, as, for example, in Iran, on a people, they don't like it, and sometimes there's a response. And I wish that I wish that if people are going to wage war, I wish they would stick to just war principles. But nobody does, and that's one of the reasons wrong. That's one of the things wrong with war. So this, of course, has been this is like fertilizer on the grass for these people. I mean, they love it. All of a sudden, their chests are out. They're much more important. They're striding around. When Bush or Cheney go through town, it's like the emperor moving with huge caravans and helicopters and armed guards. And there was an interesting story in the Washington Post the other day about Paul Bremer, who still has massive Secret Service protection, and how he had to stop at a drugstore to pick up some cough drops, and how the Secret Service with the guns kept a mother from going back to her car where her child was, because Bremer had to go in and get the cough drops. So this guy, you know, this boob and monster who had done so much damage in Iraq, still is striding around here at taxpayer expense as an imperial official. So I would argue that empire is wrong, imperialism is wrong, colonialism is wrong, that we need to mind our own business. We need to not be fooling around in other people's countries. We do need to be not overthrowing their governments, installing governments friendly to us, so-called pro-Western. Pro-Western, of course, always means takes U.S. government orders. Democracy means under the control of the U.S. Freedom means under the control of the U.S. When you hear them about spreading democracy, of course, it's not democracy if people vote the way the U.S. doesn't want. Then that's a bad thing, as in the Ukraine or whatever. It has to be overturned. Democracy means the result that the U.S. wants. That's what. So this we see the U.S. As an empire, the biggest, most powerful empire in the history of the world, the richest by many, many magnitudes. I mean, forget the Russians or the Romans or the British or anybody else. This is by far the biggest. And the U.S., of course, seeks to be, like all empires, a world government. They seek to bring the whole world, or at least all the economically powerful nations, under their sway. They're willing to do many things about this in order to try to bring it about. I think there are reasons stemming from economics and politics why they can't actually do it, but they can do a whole lot of damage in trying to do it. And I think it's, you know, we're living in scary times, but I don't think that's a reason to lose hope. I think there actually is a lot of reason for hope, because the government is always a mess. I mean, they always, thank goodness, as somebody once said, we don't get all the government we pay for. So the government is, as anybody has ever been in the military or worked in the post office or whatever, this is not a very efficient bunch. Thank goodness, because they can't do everything evil they would like to do.
And we've only got like a minute left, but what would you like from your colleagues or your comrades, potential comrades on the left? What kind of coalition do you foresee between us?
Well, I just think recognize that there are some libertarian anti-war and pro-civil liberties people. I don't know that the coalition is possible. I mean, we just sort of maybe just cheer each other on when we think the other is right. And I guess I'd say one thing to people on the left. Remember, the government that is trying to run the world, that runs these wars, that is running Iraq the way they'd like to be running America, by the way. That's, if you want to see the kind of government they would actually like in this country, look to Iraq, price controls and total socialism and so forth. So I would say, think that when you realize that the government is so bad in so many areas where you and I would agree it's bad, I think maybe that it ought not to be running the economy either.
All right, well, thank you for joining us. I'm sure a lot of people are surprised to hear this sort of thing coming from someone would normally be classed in the political right.
Shall I give my email address?
Please do.
If anybody wants to write me, Lou, L-E-W, at lourockwell.com. That's lewrockwell.com.
And, of course, the website, lourockwell.com as well. Thank you for joining us, Lou
Doug,
Rockwell.
Thank you.
And we may be in touch in the future. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back at some unspecified future date because we don't know what's happening with the fundraiser, but I'll be back sometime soon. And in the meanwhile, stay tuned to WBAI for the rest of the evening, and let's go out with a bit more from Glenn Branca's lesson number one.